We're going to start here, even though this is not technically part of the Dena'ina site, but I wanted to talk just briefly. Where's Sandra? Sandra. Okay, well, she'll be coming. And this has to do with the concept of a place and its meaning. So, I think about 4 years ago, there were a number of epidemic suicides in Southwest Alaska, and we had a number of students here. I don't know why suicides can be sequential. But I do know that in this case, a college has a responsibility to do what it can. So there's probably a few psychology majors here, and I know there's at least one. There's two, right? And I'm not saying that talk therapy doesn't help, but ritual can also help. So Sandra, who's coming, there she is, organized a traditional cloth ceremony. Helen was there to help guide it. Max Chickalusian from Tyonek and his brother Chad were there. Danita Peter came to help organize it. A traditional healing ceremony, and we had it right here. We did not have it inside, even though it was cold. We didn't have it in an inside setting. We had it here, and the two key ingredients were a fire pit and the river. The Great Northern Fire Pit, universal across the north. You've got one at your house. And if you don't, you got to go home and build one. And the river. And about this number of people, actually there were 80 people came. And without a lot of advertising. Sandra, get closer here, because you're going to talk in a little bit here. Yeah, you. Yeah. Yeah, so Sandra organized it. And we put some money into it, not a lot, for travel. And Max was probably the main person to organize the songs and the procedures so that it followed protocols. And essentially, it's a cloth tied together, gingham cloth. And everybody holds on. And there are songs. George was there. Where's George?
He's coming.
Okay.
He's bringing his drum.
Oh, okay. And and others. And people talked about their feelings having to do with stresses in life. And one thing I remember as we're standing holding the cloth is the fire burned straight up. You know, usually it's kind of waving and the smoke's going this way and that way. The fire and the smoke went straight up. I don't know what to make of that, but I just remember it. And then we went inside and we ate. Mm-hmm. And the Kenaichi tribe brought the food. And I think of it, as I remember it, as a time of very good feeling. Mm-hmm. Everybody was laughing and talking and moving around. And so that ceremony somehow, I don't know if relieved is the right word, dealt with some serious stress. And rituals work. rituals work. And not everyone was native there. I don't know.
Yeah.
Native or not, rituals do work. So the fire pit needs to get used more. Anything you want to say about that time? Or?
Sure. The ceremony was brought about as a relief for students and also staff and faculty of having, you know, lost somebody. So there was a lot of loss that was happening here on campus, not on campus, but on in for our students and for staff and faculty. And it was a really trying time. It was that one time too when that gentleman took his life at AFN. And we all came back with a heavy, heavy, heavy heart. And it brought up a lot of other loss that people had been experiencing at that time. And we didn't know if people were gonna be able to make it here to, come together. And I had talked with our elders. There was Helen, there's our elders up in Copper Center, and then also our Tyonic elders, Max Chickalushin and Danina Slauson, and asked them, you know, what can we do? And they said that we needed to do the cloth ceremony so that it stops that cycle of thinking. It's like when stuff like that happens, because of the grieving connects to somebody else, and then it connects to somebody else, and connects to some. There has to be a way to break that grieving. And this was how we were gonna do it. And we came together, and like Dr. Boris said, everybody came together. There was over 40 people standing here.
80 people.
Oh, goodness. There
80.
Was 80. and we were hoping for 20. That's what we were hoping for. We were hoping for 10. We're hoping for 5. Just so that we could break that cycle. And Max knew how to bring us all together to sing songs, to help us with the pain, so that we could share together that experience. And I think that, and he also was able to take us through that process so that we could also come out of it together in a positive way. So when we left, we were all laughing at the end of the circle. When we came, there was such heaviness with us that, and then we had a whole bunch of food in there, and everybody was singing and having food. It was just like it never happened. And I heard people say that it was like home. And I'd like to do more things like that on campus with the help of elders, because we couldn't do this without them, because there's certain ways you have to do it. It isn't just something that you do and it's fun, or, I mean, there's a lot of thought and preparation to get ready mentally and also physically. So I was glad that you were able to help us get that going here on campus. And Gary Turner too. And it was really nice, and it really did help and stop things. And it lifted everybody up for that really tragic time.
Gary's the director. He got a little worried because when we built the fire, smoke went up and sucked into the vents in the buildings.
Oh, see, I don't hear about that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, anyway.
But it really helped the students and staff.
Yeah, and well, you want to talk about the potential of that night?
Sure. Which part?
A couple of people we heard had planned. One other thing while we're here, and then we're going to move on, because this is not an all-day field trip. Mm. On that rise right there, you can look downriver and upriver. Some people sense things there. And I don't know. I'm just pointing it out. either way, it's a very special place. And the people who lived here in 1200, 1300, 1400 AD undoubtedly would have known of that place because we're going to that village now. So there are special places. You may have one that you go to, and I'll bet it's outside. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is one. And if you are a student here, exams are coming, stress, go up there, sit for a bit, ground yourself. I'll bet it helps. Okay, I'm marching on, and we're going to walk about 300 yards, and we'll stop up there. Here we go. So, this is one of, I think it's about 85, I forget the count. It's between 85 and 100. Eslinto, at least that's one word for it. Helen might have another, or Charlie might have another. Underground cold storage pit. Around the year 1000 AD, the Dena'ina and Atna invented these pits. Once they were invented, just exactly where, of course, we don't know, but they spread like wildfire from the Mulchatna River area to the west, to the Copper River area to the east. So what they did is solve the problem of how to store salmon caught in the summer and fall for winter and spring. No one else had done that, in exactly this way. It's a remarkable invention, simple but effective. So there's a lot of moss and such in the bottom of this, so it would be another foot or two deep. There's another one right over here. There's another one right here. It would be dug down and lined with birch bark. The birch bark was sown with spruce root and smeared with fish eggs, slightly dried fish eggs, at every seam. And then lined with moss, plenty of moss around here, probably dry moss. And then another layer of birch bark, same thing, sown and smeared with fish eggs, making a thermal unit. It's like a bunny boot, right? Waterproof on the outside, waterproof on the inside, insulation in between. This, or shortly, as it begins to freeze, it will begin to freeze, right? This is crazy fall. Almost froze at my place this morning. But it will begin to freeze. As we get into freeze up, the fish, we'll talk about the fish being caught, and on drying racks, would be put into the pit, probably put in frozen. Another layer, and then a layer of grass, layer of fish, layer of grass, fish, grass, until it's full. And then birch bark, moss, birch bark over the top. And a stake, so you can find it in February, if it snows. It will snow here, right? So those fish would remain frozen, even though December we get it's 35 degrees or so or whatever, because it's in the ground with this thermal unit, it's frozen. The fish that would be the target fish, at least in this river system, would be silver salmon or coho salmon, the last running fish. And they're running now. They spawn up the, in this case, Slatnu, Little Creek. The mouth of Slatnu is Slatnukak, anglicized to Slycock, that river right here. There were, I counted, I think it's 8 ways of fishing, but in this area, probably the main one would be to build a pole and lattice, sort of a dam, but the water flows through a weir across the creek. So with a little container in the back, fish come up the creek, they go in through the gate, and it's hard for them to get back out. Somebody standing there taking out the fish, somebody on the bank is cleaning them, preparing them to be dried on drying racks until freeze up when they're put in here. You could, of course, do it with red salmon or any other salmon, but the main problem would undoubtedly have been bacteria. So you want to minimize the time from when you catch the fish to when you put it in the ground, frozen, because bacteria would, you know, that's a bummer. That sucks. That's an anthropology term. So, a couple of things. These were overproduced. So there's about 100 in this area. Probably wouldn't need that many. But if bacteria got into 1 or 2, then you would have others to rely on. In addition, it changed the social structure. So a village was, I don't know if controlled is the right word, but an individual that in Denaina is called Geshka. Geshka? Geshka. It was his or her responsibility to see that the fish made it through the winter. And so, I see some younger students here. Anybody, you don't have to raise your hand, but anybody living in an apartment with 3 or 4 others? So what's the problem? Hey, who drank my beer? You open the refrigerator, right? Hey, who ate my sandwich? So you figure out your solution is probably, this is my shelf. This is your shelf. I will put my food and my beer on this shelf. You don't touch my shelf. I won't touch your shelf. And however, down the line. Am I right? A couple of, it's the guys that are nodding. So this was a way to solve who got access to the food, but it was also the Geshka's responsibility to redistribute the food back to the Ukilka, the clan helpers, on a need basis. So he or she might say in, I don't know, December, go to probably a young guy. Young guys, they get sent back and they say, bring in X amount of salmon and then cover it up again. So his job or her job was to be sure that the salmon made it through the winter. But they overproduced. So what's that about? So this is a social political system where each Geshka had a partner Geshka in another village. So let's say in that village, maybe a bear wakes up, or a wolverine, worse yet, or bacteria gets into much of their food. So they're hurting. This partner would be obligated to distribute food from here to there. And why would he do that? Reciprocity. Because someday it might be the opposite. It might be this village that needs help. And the reciprocal agreement would hold. A political, social organization that enhanced survivability. Another reason why the Atna and Dena'ina were very sustainable cultures. A mechanism to distribute food equitably. So, this time of year would have been, would have been an anxious time of year. You've been fishing, drying fish, and now let's say we have a warm spell. Do you want a warm spell? No, you don't want warm weather. Your sky reader is looking and wondering when the cold weather is going to come, because you want cold weather to get the food into the ground frozen. Do you want warm weather? See, you're all affected by television or the internet. The ideal is Southern California, right?
No.
Oh, thank God.
Not even Florida.
Yeah. Why anyone would want to live where the plastic on your dashboard melts is beyond me. So this, as I say, was developed in Dena'ina territory and in Atna territory. And both had these type of systems. So I had a drawing of one of these, a schematic, and Helen was kind of walking by and looking over my shoulder a couple of years ago. Do you remember that, Helen? And Helen said, you know, when I was a girl, I ate food out of one of those. You want to tell them the story? So move in.
They call it chukilin. It's cold weather like this. You know, they get really busy to make a fish pit so they can put fish in. They get all the bark from the trees or from the perch. So they pile it up and they catch fish, they cut the guts and they just flay it, they put it down there and they put a lot of grass and then they put that stuff, bark, and then they do another one. So when they fill it up, they put that tree bark. So they wait for cold, get real cold, so they cover up, and so there's no, doesn't sour. So in the winter, they mark it before snow, so they, in the winter they go and pick some fish. And it's good. I think it's better than refrigerator. It's good and soft. It doesn't get soft.
Really?
No, it doesn't. It's fresh if they do it really good. So that's how they did the old folks. They add to the, put it on the plate. I think they did put a little rock salt on it, just a little flake. turn the fire apart. So they use that to deduct that. And that's what they use for eggs or flour when they want to put eggs in flour. Smash it and use it. We use it for lots of things. That's really good. It's better than eggs. They taste better.
Good.
Don't get hungry. Keeps you healthy.
There you go.
Oh,
oh. Dr. Boers, Charlie was saying something about the Atna region too.
Charlie.
In the further north, Atna region, there wasn't too much fish like the village I was born in. It was mostly moose and caribou. And when they caught it in the fall time, you hung it so the meat would skim. There'd be, what do they call it when they do that to fish that? To smoke it.
They dry meat?
Yeah. There's anyway, it forms an outer skin, and it'd be cold, and they'd put it in the ground. And another thing, like in the Copper River area, where they had salmon, they'd use it for fermenting. And of course, they didn't have cabbage, so they didn't make sauerkraut. You know, they used fish heads. They would ferment fish heads. And so they never did do the body of the fish, just the heads. It's a different texture. It holds together more firm. And so, and they call that Noschiti.
So everywhere up and down the Kenai River, where there's a creek like this, you'll find a site like this, because that's where the silvers go up to spawn. Before this time, you can't really see it from here, but you'll have to take my word for it, about half a mile upriver, and on the other side, in quite a few years ago, I had a class where we excavated a, we call it Riverine Kachemak site, before that 1000 AD time. Quite different. The village was right low on a low bench, and there were no storage pits like this, although there were pits inside the houses that were used for storage of salmon, and almost certainly it's commonly called stinkfish, fermented fish. The technique of fishing, I believe, was to drift net, spruce root drift nets down the river and catch red salmon or sockeye salmon. And here's Slycock Creek comes in. This would have been a spruce root net because we found it. We found little pieces of this net held down at the bottom by notch stones. Those of you in my class know about notch stones, like a lead line of a net to hold it down, because the red salmon go near the bank, near the bottom. And they didn't have, there aren't nearly as many of these sites because they didn't have a large scale way to store fish like this. Only the stinkfish pits. One of the pits in the house, it's about that deep, it would have been under floorboards. There were two. One was empty. The other was full of salmon bones. No heads, no tails. Ribs, vertebrae, and I forget how many, but full. So lately, I've embarked on a project to do a DNA study of those bones. So I send them to a man named Ripon Mali, who's at the University of Illinois, or he's been here many times. He maybe takes them back with him. And they do their magic, and they will be able to successfully describe the entire genome of 2,000-year-old salmon. We will then compare that to modern salmon and see what evolutionary changes have occurred. If salmon keep coming back to the same stream, I'm pointing to the biologist here, and they reproduce in the same stream more or less, either random genetic drift or some kind of adaptive mechanism may be detectable in the DNA. Did I say that well? Thank you. I'm never sure. I never have a biologist with on this, so I can always, you know, just... So that's a big deal. It means that if a developer were to ever say in a development project that, sorry, we're going to destroy the fish, but we'll put it back, they better put back fish adapted to that river. Not just any salmon. Salmon adapted to that river. And it's been proposed. The Chewitna coal mine, they were going to take out 12 miles of a major spawning stream across the inlet. And they said they'd put it back. I don't think they could put it back, frankly, but nevertheless. So, any questions?
How long would it take to prepare a pit this size, and how much fish could it hold?
Good question. So, Joel, in a class, he doesn't know this yet, is going to build one of these. So, right?
We'll find out.
We'll find out. And so we got to make a decision. Are you going to use a shovel, you know, a number two shovel, or... I don't know. You have to make that decision. One of each. Better do the shovel first. Yeah. Yeah. And I think we should build one, and we'll get an idea. I don't know, but part of the social dimension of the Dena'ina and Atna was kin-based, clan-based villages. So the clan did a lot of things. It was a kind of self-help, an extended family, if you will. But also, you owed your labor to the village. So some people would be building these. Some people, and I've got to mention, it probably was had to be rebuilt every year because I'm not sure if it was fall or spring, but they'd burn them out. So if we were to excavate here, we'd find charcoal and almost nothing else. To purge it of bacteria. I don't know that in 1000 AD they had the concept of bacteria, but they probably had something like it. Purge it, rebuild it. Probably had to rebuild the fish weir because ice, you know, skimming it out. It was essentially a lot of labor, but was it worth it? What did you get? A lot of salmon. One of the world's most nutritious and, in certain areas, abundant foods. Do not take wild salmon lightly. Alaska is the last place, essentially, where wild salmon can be caught in abundance. The last place. Salmon in Norway are farmed salmon. Anyone eaten farmed salmon besides me? What it tastes like to you?
Very bland.
And jello.
Very much so.
Salmon jello. Yeah. Right.
Definitely no fat.
Yeah, and the colored because it comes out white. Other places, well, same in Russia, Sakhalin Island, same in Japan. In Japan, the expansion of the Japanese in the mid-1800s into the Ainu area, successors to a long-standing culture that had been harvesting salmon for 10,000 years. They forced the Ainu to cement the sides of their streams to provide water for irrigation for rice, for growing rice. Traded salmon for rice. There's no wild salmon left, or very little. Go on and on. Alaska and you people, you're the future of it. The decisions you help make will affect, to the extent we can, the survivability of wild salmon, which I maintain are different from farmed salmon. They're certainly different from GMO, genetically modified salmon, and I think they're different from ranch salmon as well. Yeah. What we can't control is what happens in the open ocean. But if I were president, I would also be a little outrageous. I'd send the Coast Guard out beyond the 200-mile limit. But that's me. I probably wouldn't do that, actually. I'm just trying to make a point.
The other thing with trying to calculate like how many fish go in a cache pit, that's region river specific, because each river will have different, like region, river system will have different sized fish. So like, for example, like sockeye and the kenai are usually larger than most other sockeye. Or when you start going out to like Bristol Bay, mm-hmm. the sockeye are smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So
Testamina.
When you get off the kenai, your size fish start to shrink outside of the king salmon zone.
Even the Russian rivers.
Right, mm-hmm. And the Russians
are smaller.
Small.
Right, yeah.
Way smaller.
So the number of fish, the question of how many fish do you put in a cache pit, it's more volume.
As much as you need.
Yeah, so if you think of like how many bundles of fish, yeah. If you think of a bundle as a size of volume, or you start to get in that. And then when you dry fish, it's like how thinly do you mm-hmm. cut it? So if you're, it just there's many factors for that like numbering system.
Yeah.
It's a volume question.
And two other things. Peter Kalifornsky told me that you needed the amount of fish you needed per day per person minimum would reach from your wrist to the tip of your finger. We're going to move on. We're going to walk about the same distance, but the trail will be more humble. And so we don't have a lot of time, but we're going to go to a house. So fishing at this locality spawned sedentary living, not nomadic living, sedentary living. So we're going to go to a sedentary house and talk a bit about that. I can't remember which way. We're going to take the low road. You. See that corner right there? I'd like you to stand there. And Montana State, I'd like you to stand in that corner. A little further, you see it? A little bit further back. Stand in that corner. So everybody see the house? So, does everybody see the corners? Raise your hand. Raise your hand. Raise your hand, raise your hand. That's the corners of this house. This is likely the entrance. Slycock Creek is right down there. There's a back room. That is one of two things, either a menstrual room or a steam bath, or both. At different times. The I'm going to quickly describe the house, and then some of you might have to go to another class. But there's nothing you'll learn in that class more important than what you'll learn here. Sorry. I know. A little arrogant. But it's true. So the walls would, as described, would have been log. So first it was dug down a couple feet. Some of them are way deep. Some of them are just a little deep. Piled on the side. Log, spruce. And then posts, probably as big as my arm, sunk in the ground on either side, and then with the logs here, tied off. Another course, tied off, tied off, tied off. So they would not have had the means to notch the corners, but this way that would have kept it up. A gabled roof with supporting posts, timbers, and smaller trees laid against it with sod on the top, and or first birch bark and then sod. Further south, large spruce like Sitka spruce. Fireplace would be right here. The fireplace would be a log crib about this high. I don't know how high, but I believe it was hunkering height. So you're out all day, like you're going to be out all day, right? And what feels really good, at least in the winter, come in by that fire. And you have to hunker by the fire. Hunkering is very important. No, it's okay, you don't have to do it. No chimney, of course, but a smoke hole. Adjust the door, create a draft. Probably was smoky, but you know, our houses aren't that crystal clear today of air. I don't remember when, 8 years ago maybe, some students and I came out and we cut three sides of this sod and flopped over the sod, and there was the last fire that had been built at this house, which is very, I ponder that a lot. The older I get, the more I ponder the last fire. And you'll have it too, right? Either at a place you live or metaphorically. English students here, communication students, right? As your title of your essay, The Last Fire. We chose some charcoal from that last fire, put it in aluminum foil, wrapped it up, flopped the sod back on top, and now you can't tell we were here. So, took it in the lab, open it up, let it dry, pick out the rootlets, send it off to a radiocarbon dating lab. For my class, I know I described it. Anybody remember? You don't have time, you're lucky. And back comes the date, and I forget the exact date for here, but it was either 1200, 1300. Plus or minus a number of years.
You said about 1,200.
Yeah, I know. I hate that. When I say it differently, I said 1,200. It's 1,200.
You said about 1,200.
Yeah. Did I do that twice? Mm-hmm. Okay, then it's 1,200.
So how long ago did you find this site?
I worked here 45 years, so I knew about it within the first year. I didn't know the extent of it. In this house, probably 10 to 15. Of this time period, like most indigenous people, most of the living is outside. We're one of the few cultures that lives inside. That's why you had to think this morning about what to wear. Because we're inside people. You know, how much, what do I have to wear to get from the car to the house? But if you're outside all day, winter or summer, it's a little different ballgame. So it could hold more people is what I'm saying, by our standards. So this was a place to sleep. Oh, I forgot about that. Along either edge, raise your hand. Along either edge would have been a bench, and same on this side, about 4 feet tall, with compartments underneath, where the parents in one compartment and unmarried daughters in another compartment would sleep. And the young men or the unmarried males would sleep on top of the benches. So it's mostly for sleeping and cooking. So these are sedentary. You don't just throw something like this up, you know, in an hour or two. Sedentary villages because of salmon. Not that they would stay here all the time. This time of year, what might they be doing? Might be moose hunting or earlier caribou hunting. Might be going up to the mountains for sheep. Might be berry picking, certainly. You saw a lot of berries along the way. Other things that you would be going out, but you would come back here after you were out for a week or so. The people knew the land, like the back of their hand. But this was the base of operation. There's five of them here, six of them. Why are they so far apart? An anthropologist named Jim Fall surmised it was because of wood management. So if you're sedentary, if you're not sedentary, you're burning wood and you burn up the wood, you move somewhere where there is wood. But you don't want to move here because salmon stream. So the houses are spread apart. I think it's going to come out to be about 10 acres if I ever got around to figuring it out. To allow use some down trees here, some there, and meanwhile others grow back, fall down. I think that's going to be about the size that you would need for this area. There's one place on your map where there are two together. One of them is very large. I haven't been there in a while, but I would say maybe not twice as big as this, but pretty darn close. Out on a ridge overlooking the creek. And I believe that was one that was called a ceremonial house. Ceremonial house. Because it doesn't have extra rooms. There's one, two, three that I know of on the Kenai Peninsula, probably more. But would have been a place where ceremonies, not unlike the cloth ceremony, but with furs, would have happened.